The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're broadcasting live here from our Edstone campus on a very chilly April day. We got used to some spring weather last week, so it's hard to stay warm all of a sudden. But that's okay. It's nice and cozy here in the loft at Edstone. We have lots to get to on today's program. I'll be getting around to the Bible study on confronting sin. I've been talking about it for the last week or so, but today we should be able to squeeze in 15 or 20 minutes at the back end of the program to give some meat in due season. Also, quite a bit of news to get through on today's program as well, and I'll come to that in just a second. But first, I want to remind you, as I think I first announced last Friday, this would be on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show page at the website. You can get to that by just clicking on one of the programs there in the box to the right of the main page, and that will take you through to the Trumpet Daily Radio program page, which if you scroll down about halfway, you can leave us an audio message. Of course, we'll take your emails as well, and we'll still try to read some of the emails that come in from time to time. But I thought I'd just give you a couple of samples that have come in recent days that show you what we'd like to do with more of your comments. If you go to that page and just click on the red button, and there you're ready to go. You're ready to give us some audio feedback. This first one here comes from Colombia.
I was thinking about like having this kind of service, sending voice messages, and you people came out with the idea. Great idea. Thank you once again. Talking about the problem about homeless people in the United States, we have the same problem and probably or maybe bigger than United States in the cities in Colombia, like Medellin, in the city that I live. And drugs, forget about it. We have drugs all over the place, all the towns, small towns in Colombia. And we know all these influences, where they come from. They come from the devil and all his demons. Thank you for the service once again, and have a great night.
That's one of our listeners in Colombia. And, of course, he's commenting on the Homeless in Seattle program that we did last Friday. We had a trumpet brief on that came out on Monday, and several emails that we've read through the week as well. This next one comes from our home office, our headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Just thought I'd leave some feedback using this new tool on the website. I love it. I listen to the Trumpet Daily in the mornings at 7, and it's a great start to my day. This is the best source of news analysis as we watch and pray. I also find the Bible studies in the second segment to be very beneficial. And I love hearing some of the listener feedback, so thought I'd chime in this time with this new feature. By the way, I absolutely love all the upgrades to the website. It just keeps getting better and better. So thank you for all your hard work and the hard work of your crew. I look forward to Monday's program. Bye.
That's from one of our listeners who listens live there at Edmond at 7 a.m. Central Time there in the U.S. So if you, too, would like to, if you're daring enough to leave your own audio message, just go to the Trumpet Daily radio page on the trumpet.com website, and you, too, can submit some audio feedback. Well, today is the 70-year anniversary of the establishment of the NATO alliance. That's hard to believe. 70 years on from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, April 4th, 1949, when 12 European states came together in this U.S.-founded alliance. And today, as we know, as so many of you know, if you've been watching the news, if you've been listening to this show, you know that that alliance is beginning to break apart. But you go back to the early days of NATO. Who can forget Britain? Britain's Lord Hastings Ismay, who said the goal of the organization was to keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. That was the objective, to keep the Germans down. And this article, I think this is at Deutsche Welle, this is a German publication. It says Germany was not kept down for long, that's for sure. They weren't kept down for long, and now we see the alliance itself is beginning to unravel. The South China Post this morning, it says, tensions have soared between the U.S. and two of its NATO partners, Germany and Turkey, marring the 70th birthday celebration for the alliance. It says further on, hours before foreign ministers from the 29-member Western Alliance opened talks in Washington with a leisurely reception on Wednesday, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence delivered a stinging rebuke both to Germany over its level of defense spending. It's down around 1.3%. And if their estimates are correct, it's supposed to go even lower. Even though President Trump has been out there saying, look, you've got to pay your fair share, it's actually projected to go down in the next year. 1.3, 1.2%. So the vice president last night, he delivers, as the South China Morning Post brings out, this stinging rebuke for Germany and also Turkey for buying a major arms system from Russia, of all places. And of course, the president's been outspoken in his criticism for Germany on this pipeline deal with Russia as well. It certainly doesn't seem like Germany's behaving as an ally of the United States. That's the point that's made at the Federalist. Germany's refusal, their refusal to fund just 2%, 2%, a fraction of what the U.S. pitches in. It shows that it's not the behavior of an ally. It refers to this statement, this Federalist piece, this statement by Robert Gates back in 2011, when he said that, well, just to paraphrase, Mr. Gates said that Germany would talk a lot about the international liberal order so long as the Americans are there to pay for everything, to pay to defend the liberal order. But the day that as it says here, that they're caught not tangibly supporting this order, they would throw a tantrum and blame Washington. They'd blame Washington for the problem. And now we see that playing out. As President Trump keeps criticizing the alliance, keeps telling the alliance members to pay their fair share, and Germany won't do it. They just won't do it. Quoting Mr. Gates, this is from 2011. It says, future U.S. political leaders, those for whom the Cold War was not the formative experience that it was for me, may not consider the return on Americans' investment in NATO worth the cost. So some prescient remarks by Mr. Gates from back in 2011 saying that, look, pretty soon there's going to be an American leader who comes along and says, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. We're funding all of this, and these European members, they don't have to build up their own security forces at all. They don't have to pay anything. They can just take it for granted. As I said, the projection is for Germany to spend 1.3% toward NATO or toward defense. That's this year, and then it's supposed to go down to 1.2%. by 2023. So they're going in the wrong direction. Now, the other side of this story is that, truthfully, you don't want Germany going it alone and building up its own military, not when you understand history, certainly not when you understand Bible prophecy. But just coming back to this division, the Federalist brings out some good points. It says, in short, Germany's not even trying to increase NATO funding, but actually planning to decrease it in a rub to the American and British taxpayers who subsidize European security. See, it's paid for by American and British taxpayers. It says, adding insult to injury, some German politicians accused the American ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, of acting like a colonial viceroy or high commissioner of an occupying force and wished he would leave Germany immediately. The Federalist says, you read that right. They're calling for Grenell to leave, the ambassador to Germany. They're calling for him to leave Germany. It says Germany refused to pay for its share in NATO, and when the American ambassador pointed that out, the German leaders wanted him. They wanted to make him a persona non grata and take away his position. He criticized them for not paying their fair share, and they called him. They said he was like a high commissioner of an occupying force of all things, and they called for him to be removed. This is Germany today. Is this the behavior of an American ally? Is this the way an American ally responds? America's funding the operation. America's funding the alliance and has been for 70 years. It's a pretty shocking reaction to Grenell's statements. They don't want to hear the truth. It says, in a similar time frame, which I'm sure is purely coincidental, the EU fined Google for the third time, and Germany signaled it would continue to be protectionist in trade. The Federalist says, Germany's not behaving like an ally. They're not acting like a partner in this alliance. There's too much open hostility toward America, toward the Trump administration. Too much sanctimonious lecturing, whether it's Grenell or Donald Trump or whoever. This author at the Federalist says, oddly, however, I have yet to see a single op-ed on how Merkel is wrecking the very foundation of the Euro-Atlantic peace by importing Russian gas to Europe and calling for a European army to replicate NATO. No one writes about this at the New York Times. No one at MSNBC says, well, hang on a second, Merkel's ruining this alliance. Merkel's splitting apart this alliance. No, all of that blame, that's reserved for Donald Trump. Solely, he's the sole recipient of blame for splitting apart the NATO alliance because he said one or two things about paying their fair share and about fair trade. That's intolerable as far as the left-wing press is concerned. That is not allowed. It is not allowed for a U.S. president to say something such as that. Now, Merkel, she can do whatever she wants. She can lower. She can actually go in the other direction. Nowhere near the 2%. She can say with France, let's build our own army. We can't trust the United States anymore. Where are the op-eds? Where are the editorials? Where are the commentaries about what Germany's doing to sever this alliance? You don't hear it or see it anywhere. It's an upside-down world. It goes back, this article does, to statements that President Kennedy made in the 60s. Look, we can't continue to pay for everything. But see, Kennedy, he was the darling of the left-wing media. So they certainly wouldn't criticize him for that. They would praise him, I'm sure. But they despise Donald Trump. So anything he says, Europe, anything he says about Europe, well, Europe has to be right. Europe has to be in the right. Angela Merkel, she has to be in the right. She can't be wrong. It's all Donald Trump. You can see why you need thetrumpet.com. You're not going to get the straight scoop. You're not going to get news. You're going to get plenty of fake news. It says the new reality is that NATO is bloated and the German strategy of buck passing is evident. Contrary to popular opinion, the first NATO expansion idea in the early 1990s was from Germany, under the cynical and crafty Volker Rühe, who was clear about German frontiers shifting towards Russia. It was not the East Europeans who, even though they were rightfully feeling threatened by Russia, driving the enlargement. It was Germany. Let's push east. Let's reach toward Russia. And the United States just kind of stupidly goes along. Give them whatever they want. We'll pay for everything. No problem. Well, finally, there's a U.S. president saying that's enough. That's enough. We can't afford it. We've got our own issues to deal with. The Federalist says the reality is this. You can't lecture the people who provide security to you and definitely cannot subvert their interests without expecting an eventual pushback. That's what Germany's getting right now, a little bit of pushback. And really, it's not even that big of a push. A statement from Grinnell that you need to pay 2%, and they say, well, who do you think you are, a colonial viceroy? Who do you think you are, the high commissioner of an occupying force? Get out of here. Get out of Germany. That's our ally, Germany. In fact, the Bible says it's our lover. The Bible says that they're going to betray the United States. Do you see this? Do you see this taking shape? You certainly do. If you're watching and praying always, if you're watching unto prayer, as Peter said, how can you not see where this is leading? So many people, though, they're blind to this. They're blind to what's happening. They're just consuming left-wing media coverage, which the coverage itself is almost non-existent. But when it is covered, it's all the Trump presidency's fault. It's all their fault. It's Grinnell's fault. It's Vice President Pence's fault. It's Donald Trump's fault, you see. It says finally in this Federalist piece, it goes against prudence, it goes against realism, it goes against basic sense of justice and fairness, Germany's reaction, that is. It is said that the cure starts from the moment the problem is diagnosed. The problem here is a great power, the biggest right in the heart of Europe, actively ignoring common sense and acting in a hostile manner. It's Germany, you see, that's acting in a hostile manner. It's not the United States. The nation that's been primarily, the primary funder of the NATO alliance for 70 years. 70 years. And the objective from the beginning was to keep the Germans down. They didn't stay down for very long, did they? Oh, no. We've empowered them. And now we're looking at a beast that says, hey, you get your ambassador out of here. Who does he think he is to tell us to pay our fair share? The Federalist says German leaders want to decolonize Europe from the United States. So be it. Let them take care of their own business and see how safe and united the European Union remains when all the American troops move out from anywhere east of the Thames. Well, it's an even worse scenario when the U.S. moves out. That's the sad truth here. It's a lose-lose for the United States. We keep the defense system in place, the umbrella of protection over Europe, and it breaks the United States financially. And then we pull out, and we clear the way for the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. When we come back, we'll shift gears a bit and talk a little bit about even something that we wrote when the election of Barack Obama happened there at the end of 2008, and many people putting their faith in him as if he was the Messiah. There was an article this week at The Week saying, don't idolize your 2020 pick. Well, we've been doing that for some time now. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical.
but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is The Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
When Beto O'Rourke announced his run for the presidency in 2020, he told Vanity Fair that he was just born to be in it. He was born for this. And his supporters are picking up on that that chosen one theme, as it says at The Week. He had a rally over the weekend a few days ago where there was a sign there saying, Beto is our Christ. He's the Messiah. So here's another one. Here's another campaign with messianic themes, just like what we saw in 2008. It says here at The Week, but there are also at least three ways in which the 2020 promises to take, Americans' idolization of political leaders to fresh heights, as if it could get any worse. Oh yes, it can. You wait. The Week says the first is structural, as the office of the presidency becomes ever more powerful and unbound by constitutional and social constraints. It is unsurprising to find Americans investing the role with salvific significance. If he has all of this power, we better make sure he gets into the one we want, gets into office. It says when you're electing a god, the stakes are high. The second factor at play in 2020 and beyond is the decline of our outlets for our religiosity. We're just becoming less and less religious, far removed from anything having to do with the Bible or God. And the article makes the point that the more our religious participation declines, the more that politics fills the void, and politics become our religion. It says, so we substitute state for church, voting for prayer, celebrity endorsers for clergy, and human props for saints as we pick our preferred deity on the ballot. Beto is not your Christ, neither is Trump nor anyone else who runs for president. Political idolatry is a sure route to disappointment. Your idol may look golden, but his feet are made of clay. We read that this morning and immediately thought of the article that Joel Hilliker wrote following Obama's election in 2008, when he asked, can he deliver? Talked about all of the crying at the night of the election. And the president-elect, Barack Obama, being set up as the savior, the one who is going to eliminate global warming, and all of these other promises. Just 8 years and everything in the world would be fixed. Mr. Hilliker said, for many, many people, expectations of what the coming years will bring, this is back in 2008, expectations are floating in the stratosphere. It says in his victory speech, the new president-elect mused about the possibility of his daughters living 100 years and seeing a better world. What change will they see? What progress will we have made? He asked, this is our chance to answer that call. This is our moment. This is our time to restore prosperity and promote the cause of peace, to reclaim the American dream, and reaffirm that fundamental truth that out of many we are one, that while we breathe, we hope. And on it went. And Mr. Hilliker said, we can expect events swiftly to expose the fact that no mortal man, even one assuming the highest office in the world's most powerful country, could ever fulfill the hope that people have invested in this individual. And yet we learn nothing. We learn nothing, even from the recent past. This was just 2008. Now we're moving toward 2020, and we have the new Messiah, or perhaps many of them. And think about the way that the news media received Barack Obama and his administration, and the way that they still look back on that administration. Andrew Klavan, he had a piece at the Wire, just talking about the media's hostility toward Donald Trump. And he said, really, the beginning stages of this media scandal, all these attacks on Trump, all of these lies, all of this fake news, really the origin of all this goes back to the Obama presidency. Klavan says the problem's not the way they treat Trump. The problem's the way they treated Obama. No one would blame a news media that was equally hard on any, or equally hard rather, on everybody, right and left, if they were fair with both sides, if they just slandered, if they just tore into both sides. Well, you could at least say, at least they're objective, at least they're consistent. But it says here, the president is a powerful guy. The press should feel free to dog him at will. But after 8 years of blaming George W. Bush for everything, from intelligence failures to the weather in New Orleans, the media, heartstruck by Obama's leftism and mesmerized by the color of his skin, laid down on the job and allowed him and his corruption to vanish in plain sight. They just gave him a pass on every single thing. And he brought a lot of corruption to the White House. He used the IRS to silence the opposition, his opponents, his political opponents. Klavan says his State Department became a front of cover-up and lies. His attorney general announced that he was the president's wingman. This is the attorney general, the leading law enforcement official in the United States. I'm the president's wingman. And he proved it by stonewalling Congress to bury the Fast and Furious scandal until he was held in contempt. That's Eric Holder. Held in contempt. It says, and his Justice Department and FBI became so stoned on the haze of power and sanctimony, they decided it was up to them to save the nation from its free choice of president. Having let the Democrat presidential candidate off the hook for genuine malfeasance, they went after the Republican tooth and nail on the basis of a creepy piece of Oppo research partially supplied by, guess who, the Russians. This is just in the last couple years. Klavan says, and all the while, the media served as a magic ring that kept Obama and his corruption from becoming visible to the public at large. Obama, who appointed James Clapper, John Brennan, James Comey, and all their co-conspirators, was declared scandal-free by virtually every news outlet. Of course, he was invisible. They never saw a thing. Scandal-free, you see. They said it right when he left office. They said it just yesterday in the case of The View. This was an exchange between Joy Behar and I think Meghan McCain on The View program, clip one.
America. None of this happened in the Obama. I've never been people say if this was Obama. Nothing like this, even remotely close, ever happened in that administration.
But you know,
completely scandal free.
I think this type of thing.
Do you know a scandal? Can you name a scandal?
Yes, but I don't want to do this with you this morning.
I'd like to hear a scandal that.
But
was
I think
the
more,
Obama
right now,
the
Iran deal, number one. I mean,
that's not a scandal.
Billions of dollars in unmarked bills in the middle of the night given to Iran. Yeah, that's a big scandal.
That was there.
Completely scandal free, says the host. No scandals whatsoever, and many in the media agree with her. We put together this montage a while back. This was as Obama was leaving office, clip two.
The president prides himself on the fact that his administration hasn't had a scandal and that he hasn't done anything to embarrass himself.
Look, I'm proud of the fact that with 2 weeks to go, we're probably the first administration in modern history that hasn't had a major scandal in the White House.
The president was 8 years scandal-free. He had,
Fast and Furious, and his entire family.
But this is a president who's gone out with no personal scandal.
And he's been scandal-free, frankly, in the White House. We haven't had that for a while.
Having saved us from a Great Depression and having had a scandal-free 8 years in office.
They were all reading from the same talking points. You see, he's scandal-free, and the other one, it's just scandals right and left. Just one extreme or the other. One's the Messiah and the other's Hitler. Nothing in between. One is the Savior. And even though, as Mr. Hilliker said in that piece, we did see events swiftly expose the fact that Barack Obama was a mere mortal. He didn't solve the problems of the United States. Far from it. But they won't look at the facts. They won't judge by the fruits. In their minds, he's still to be worshipped. What about all the columns since he left office? Not just from Joe Schmo, from media types. The former executive editor at the New York Times carrying around a little plastic Obama doll and pulling it out every now and then to remind herself when the United States was so wonderful. She's got the little Obama doll to make her feel good. Another one writing, this is for the New York Times in August of 2017. President Obama, now is the time to start talking, she wrote. You are an expert on constitutional law. This is like a prayer for deliverance. And an embodiment of the ideals expounded by the so-called American dream. It's time for you to come back. We need you to get yourself out there and to speak for us, to defend us, to attack President Trump. Well, and on it goes. You could find 1,000 examples. He's to be worshipped. He can do no wrong. Even all of this with Clapper and Brennan. And Comey. Even all of this illegal activity, no scandal, they say. Nothing scandalous about this $30 million investigation involving 19 left-wing prosecutors and 40 FBI agents, 13 countries, thousands of records, subpoenas, everything you could imagine. And we get to the end and find that there's no collusion and they're not satisfied. They're not satisfied. They're not the least bit contrite. They're not. They don't turn introspective at all at the news of this hoax, this giant hoax. Instead, they just move along. We're just a few days out from that report. And now the president, he stumbles a little bit on Wednesday with a few of his comments. And uh-oh, he's got Alzheimer's. He's crazy. He's mentally deranged. Listen to Lawrence O'Donnell from the other night, clip three.
How often do you hear a normal person say, I think I'm very normal? Have you ever heard a president of the United States feel compelled to publicly announce, I think I'm very normal? Does that mean he knows he's not normal?
That's just the other night. That's MSNBC for you. That's nightly news in the United States. The president says in a speech, in a rally, I think I'm very normal. And of course, we can take that to mean that he's very abnormal and that he knows it. He knows it. O'Donnell went on to say this, clip four.
You had a right to wonder today if there's something wrong with the workings of the president's mind, especially if you watched him repeatedly struggle to say the word origin. What kept coming out was something that sounded like oranges.
because President Trump's the only president in history to ever stumble over a word, to ever make a misstatement, to ever say something accidentally. But he does it. He does it on Wednesday, and I think it's the early stages of Alzheimer's. You had a right to wonder. You had a right to wonder on Wednesday if the president was unstable mentally, if there's something wrong with his mind. It's hard to believe these people. They think Donald Trump is deranged. There's a lot of mental instability in the left-wing media. So obsessed with taking down this president, so blinded by their own bias. You want to go back to origins? Go back to America Under Attack. That section, you'll remember it, many of you. That section my father had on how that they swooned. Remember that Michael Hastings quote? They swooned before Barack Obama. He was giving this. This is the late Michael Hastings. He's now dead. Car accident, I think. But he's on Martin Bashir's show on January of 2013. And he talked about the just being in the presence of Barack Obama, the press corps, the people that followed him every day, and that when they're near him, they lose their minds. Reporters. They're near a president and they lose their minds. That is mental instability. Losing all sense of objectivity. You talk about mental derangement. They're enraptured by Barack Obama. My father asked in the booklet, what is going on? Reporters swooning and acting like nervous teenagers around a politician? Is that normal? I don't remember ever reading anything like this in American politics. Klavan's right. Klavan's right at The Wire. The media scandal today is really an Obama scandal. It traces its origin back to what they were saying and the way they were reacting to the election of Barack Obama in 2008. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with our long-anticipated study on confronting sin. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations, everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
coming right up to the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And you'll recall what the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 5 about our Passover being sacrificed for us. And because of this, we ought to go on and to observe the days of unleavened bread. In other words, we ought to go on and come out of sin because our Passover is sacrificed for us. And so how do we react to that awesome sacrifice? For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. We go out. We follow God. We submit to his will. We go on the offensive. We fight against sin. We confront sin. Listen to what my father said in a Key of David program from a few years ago on God's Holy Day Plan, clip 5.
See, after our Christ's death, we understand that. We know we've been had our sins forgiven. And then we began to work not to sin and to get sin out of our lives. That holy day of unleavened bread where we come out of Egypt, come out of the world, come out of sin, and get sin out of our lives. We begin to build that character so we can let God reproduce himself. We can't remain the way we are and ever be born into the family of God. We simply can't do that.
We just can't stay where we are. We have to go forward. We have to follow Christ out of Egypt, just like the Israelites followed the pillar cloud, out of Egypt, out of sin, and on into the promised land. Well, they had to wander about for quite a while because they wouldn't submit to God's authority. They wouldn't submit to God's will. They would gripe and complain. They would resist against Moses' leadership. They would criticize Moses. Instead of just following God. But he says there, we can't stay where we are and expect to be born into God's family. We can't do it. We've got to get rid of sin. We've got to leave sin. We've got to forsake sin. In a sermon back in 1982, Herbert Armstrong said this about our fight against sin, clip 6.
We have got to get so sick of sin in this life and have overcome sin and fought so hard to overcome sin in this life that we never want to sin again and we never will. And in the kingdom, we'll be made so we can't sin. We won't want to. It's impossible for God to sin. And the only reason it's impossible, it isn't that he doesn't have the power to sin. It's simply that he has set his mind that he won't. And there's no other power great enough to make him do it. Oh, thank God for that. That's wonderful.
It's wonderful, this purpose, this plan, how resolute God is in resisting against sin. He just won't do it. It's impossible for him. He has the power. He could sin if he wanted to, but he won't. And he wants us to submit to that same power in our lives, to where we just submit to his will and overcome and conquer sin. John chapter 2, let's just look at an example here in the second chapter of the Gospel of John, a remarkable book, a gospel that, as my father has pointed out, it really is, it's full of unique instruction. Even different from the other three gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John, of course, is writing this some 30 years after the events that the book depicts. And so he had more time to maybe think a little bit more deeply about these events from Christ's ministry. He's the only one of the four gospel writers that goes back to the pre-existence of Christ as the Word. You can see that in John 1. In fact, there's quite a few things covered in John's Gospel that aren't even really covered much in the other three Gospels. The exchange between Jesus and Nicodemus. The other gospel writers, they discuss the bridegroom. John is the one who mentions the bride. He refers to the I Am government, which is unique. He's the only one that referred to the incident at Jacob's well. That's in John 4. Then at the end of the book, he has this exchange with Peter about feeding God's sheep. That's only in the book of John. And John also, he expounds on the dramatic events surrounding the death and resurrection of Lazarus. Well, look at what he says here in John 2, verse 9. It says, when the ruler of the feast had tasted the water and was made wine and knew not whence it was, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, every man at the beginning does set forth good wine when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But you have kept the good wine until now. So this is at a wedding reception, the one where Jesus turned water to wine, one of his first miracles. And it says, this beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. So all of these miracles, they had quite an impact on Christ's disciples. And it says in verse 12, after this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brethren, his family, in other words, and his disciples, and they continued there not many days. So he went from Cana to Capernaum, where he was with his family for a short while. And it says in verse 13, and the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So this was in the first year of his ministry, 28 AD. This was early on in the ministry of Jesus Christ. He travels to Jerusalem. He goes there for the spring holy days, Passover and the days of unleavened bread. He observed these days. He's the God of the Old Testament, he's the one that revealed them to the patriarchs, to Moses, to Abraham. And then when he came in the flesh, in the first century AD, he observed them. This was his custom. But notice what happens here when he visits Jerusalem. It says in verse 14, and he found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and changers of money. The money changers were there. They just turned the temple of God into, something like a supermarket or a mall where they just wanted to make money. This, of course, is where Jesus Christ confronts these merchants, these money changers who set up their shops inside the temple of God. And there's another incident similar to this covered in the other Gospels, but this one evidently is a different one. It came up, I guess, more than once. In any event, it happens early on in his ministry. The other one referred to in the other Gospels, I think, was later in his ministry. In any event, notice what happens here. Verse 15, and when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep, and the oxen, and he poured out the changers' money, and he overthrew the tables. So when he saw this flea market set up inside the temple, when he saw that, he grabbed a cluster of small cords or ropes, and he started whipping the cattle. He started snapping the whip in the air. He angrily knocked over vessels full of coins and overthrew tables even. This is Jesus Christ. This is the real Messiah. This is how he reacted to sin. Open, blatant sin going on inside the temple of God, God's house. He chose a whip. A few commentaries point this out. The whip being a symbol of his divine wrath. This is a God of wrath that we're reading about. A God of righteous indignation. A God of righteous anger. And he said to them, verse 16, he said to them that sold doves, take these things hence. Make not my Father's house a house of merchandise. This was his father's house. This was Jesus Christ defending his father's house. He wanted to just boot out these imposters. They wanted in so that they could make money, and Jesus would have none of it. So here is Jesus not only confronting sin in the house of God, but he was doing it for God. It was about cleaning up the house of God. And when the disciples saw all of this happen, verse 17 says that they remembered what was written in Psalm 69, where it says, "The zeal of my house has eaten me up." What does that mean? The zeal of my house, if you look at that psalm, Psalm 69, verse 7, it says, "Because for your sake I have borne reproach, shame has covered my face. I am become a stranger unto my brethren, and an alien unto my mother's children." Verse 9, For the zeal of thine house has eaten me up, and the reproaches of them that reproached you are fallen upon me. The Revised Standard Version says that for the zeal of my house has eaten me up. It's consumed me. Jesus Christ was consumed by the zeal of God's house. His strongest desire was to maintain purity in the house of God. And furthermore, it was to maintain purity in his own life. He was tempted in all points, like we are, it says in Hebrews 4, yet without sin. He didn't sin once. So every day for Christ was a battle. Every day for Christ, he agonized. He fervently cried out to God because he knew that if he just sinned once, and it certainly was possible for him to do it, Hebrews 4:15 brings that out. He knew that if he sinned once, there'd be no hope for you or me. So he had to trust God. He had to submit to God. He had to fulfill God's will. And here in John 2, you see him doing that. He kept the house of God pure. He got the sin out of the house of God, and he did it in a very confrontational way, I think you would agree. Notice again, John 2 and verse 15, it says, "And when he had made a scourge of small cords," we read this a moment ago, "when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep, and the oxen, and he poured out the changers' money," it says, "and he overthrew the tables, and he said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my father's house an house of merchandise." And his disciples remembered that it is written, "The zeal of thine house has eaten me up." It's all right to let the zeal of God, the zeal of God's house, to eat you up, to consume you. Now, my father brings out in the book, John's Gospel, the Gospel of Love, the love of God. No book in the Bible expounds on the depth of God's love quite like John's Gospel. As I say, he had some 3 decades to meditate on these subjects that he had no doubt discussed intimately with Jesus Christ before he was crucified. He spent a lot of time meditating on these truths, on these teachings. He covered a lot of things that aren't even covered in other Gospels. And you wonder if soon after this incident in John 2, if Jesus told him, "You make sure you tell your readers, those who will read your gospel centuries from now, you tell them about this explosive confrontation that essentially began my ministry. Tell them about my fiery zeal. Tell them about me purifying the house of God. Tell them about the scourge of cords, the whipping and the shouting, the overturning of tables. Tell them about my righteous indignation. That phrase in the Psalms, consumed by zeal, Barnes' commentary says, it has absorbed me or engaged my entire attention and affection, has surpassed all other feelings, so that it may be said to be one great absorbing affection and desire of the mind. Here is an example set for ministers and for all Christians. In Jesus, this was the great commanding sentiment of his life. It should be also the great commanding sentiment to just be eaten up, to just be consumed. Consumed, as it says in the Psalm, by the house of God, by God's standard of righteousness. What an example Jesus set for us, and what an example to keep in mind as we go forward into the spring festival season. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send an email, you can write to td@kpcg.fm. And don't forget the audio message you can leave us as well at thetrumpet.com website. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.